Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Keep up with the latest news and happenings at Beth Emmanuel by subscribing to our free monthly e-newsletter. Click on the News tab or go to BethEmmanuel.org/newsletter to sign up.
So we're going to finish up Romans chapter 11, which is what I meant to do 2 weeks ago and didn't make it all the way through. And you'll remember we reached the point, midpoint, as we're working through Romans 11, where Paul came out and he said, "Now I'm speaking to you Gentiles." And I made a big deal about that, that this was a significant moment in a Pauline writing where he actually addresses it, specifically his audience, saying, "This is my audience now." So at this point, verse 13, he knows that everybody else is also listening and reading. But he's segmented off a portion of his readership. It's not really readership, even. You know, I mean, it's not like people passed these around and say, "Hey, did you get Paul's latest letter? You should really read this." Instead, the idea of the epistles that were sent out by the apostles was that they were to be read at the public assembly. So when the congregations came together, they were read publicly, I think in the place of the sermon, the teaching, the drasha for that day, was this teaching from the apostle, a word of exhortation from the apostle. That's how I understand it. That's how I imagine it. You got to imagine, we're reading this epistle, we're gathered together as a community of believers in Rome. It's largely a Gentile community, but nevertheless with Messianic Jewish presence. You know, I don't know what the numbers are. Maybe it's 50-50, maybe it's two-thirds Gentiles. As our definition of in-house, coming together as believers here in Rome, and we're maybe one of several different communities of believers in Rome. And we're hearing this epistle being read to us by a reader, someone who is a professional. He does this. He reads. He does the whole, like, stretches out his hand. You know, "Paul, an apostle," and begins reading like this. And so, seated in this room to hear the epistle from the apostle, we've got these different kinds of people, right? There's Jewish believers, there's the proselytes, and there's these Gentile believers. And so Paul reaches his point in this discourse where he says, "Now, at this point, I am speaking to you, seated in the room, listening to the recitation or the reading of this epistle, to those of you who are Gentiles." And this is where he went into the material regarding the concept of being grafted into the nation of Israel. And he said, "If the dough offered as first fruits," this is just review for you, "if the dough offered as first fruits is holy, so is the whole lump. And if the root of the tree is holy, so are the branches." And so we worked with that metaphor. I gave you two possible interpretations. I told you my preference. And so this time as we review, we're just reviewing my preference for the interpretation. When he says the first fruits of the dough, he's referring to Messianic Jewish believers. So he's referring to a segment of people that are seated in that room listening to the recitation or the reading of this epistle. The Messianic Jews in the room, even. Messianic Jews who are present. And if the Messianic Jews represent the first fruits of the dough, then the whole lump that is holy, what is that? Well, that refers to the non-Messianic Jews, which were the subject of the discussion, the larger Jewish community, of which the Messianic believers are just a small subset from a very large and prosperous Jewish community in Rome, right? All right, and then same metaphor then with the tree. The root, if the root of the tree is Messianic Jewish believers, and the Messianic Jewish believers are sanctified, are holy, then so too the branches. So the branches, what are the branches? Then the branches are non-Messianic Jews, they're greater Israel, the rest of Israel. So in Paul's mind, Messianic Jewish believers are performing a sort of priestly function on behalf of the entire nation, much in the way that Yeshua stands to the Messianic Jewish person, the Messianic Jewish community stands in relationship to the greater nation of Israel as a representative piece of the nation, representing the whole. by their confession of faith in King Messiah and accepting the kingdom and redemption and forgiveness and entering the new covenant and so on and so forth. Not just for themselves, not just as individuals, not just as like, well, I'm sure glad I'm going to heaven, and not just on that level, but rather as a representative of the whole nation. However that's going to work out in Paul's theology, so, you know, we don't know. But that's how I'm understanding what he says. So then he goes on, he says, and I'm speaking to the Gentiles at this point. He says, I'm speaking to you, Messianic Gentiles. You'll say, okay, if some branches, that is the Jewish people, were broken off from the tree, from spiritual Israel, and you, although a wild olive shoot, were grafted in among the others and now share in the nourishing root of the olive tree, that is the faith of the remnant, the Messianic Jewish faith, do not be arrogant toward the branches, that is the Jewish people who are not disciples of Yeshua. Because if you are arrogant towards Jewish people who are not believers in Yeshua, remember, it's not you who support the root. It's not you who supports Messianic Jewish remnant. But the root, the Messianic Jewish remnant that supports you. All right, so how do we understand that? I think Paul's speaking in spiritual terms. I think he's speaking in the spiritual representative terms. But also, just on a very practical level, it's through Messianic Jewish teaching, the revelation of the gospel that comes through the Messianic Jewish teaching, the Jewish believers, and that these Gentiles even have this concept of having any sort of place, position with the God of Israel through his son Yeshua in the first place. Just on a very practical level. I mean, set aside the mysticism. Just on a practical level. It's the root, the Messianic Jewish remnant that supports you. All right. So, don't be arrogant over Jewish people. But you will say, well, branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. All right. Paul says that's true. What's not true that you might be grafted in specifically, but they were broken off because of unbelief regarding the message of the gospel. They did not repent, but you stand fast through faith. So do not become proud, but rather you should fear. For if God did not spare the natural branches, neither will he spare you. Yeah. All right.
How would you define broken off?
How would I define broken off?
In terms of either spiritually or physically, or
right?
Whatever else. I mean,
yes. Okay. So the question is, when Paul refers to Jewish people who rejected the message of the gospel, does broken off indicate cut off from the nation, as in, you know, you shall be cut off? Does it indicate damned? Yeah.
People read that into it.
Right. Right. I don't know. I don't know what Paul has in mind here by broken off in this regard. But whatever it is, he doesn't see it as an irreversible state. He warns that, you know, whatever this condition is, says, if God did not spare the natural branches, neither will he will spare you. And now he's going to warn that they can be grafted back in. And now watch how he does it. So, I don't really know how to define. I don't want to get into passing that judgment because Paul's not clear. He says, note then the kindness and severity of God. Severity towards those who have fallen. This is the natural branches. But kindness to you, provided you continue in his kindness. The way Paul's using kindness here is his Hebrew mind is thinking chesed. We're thinking of chesed here, covenant devotion. That's how we would be translating this. So God's devotion to you, provided you continue in his devotion, continue devoted to him. Otherwise, you too will be cut off. How do we define you too will be cut off? And even they, if they do not continue, the they here, I should have defined for you, they, unbelieving Israel, even if they do not continue in their unbelief regarding the Messiah, Yeshua, and the gospel, and the good news of repentance, they will be grafted in, for God has the power to graft them in again. For if you were cut off from what is by nature a wild olive tree, that is other people's, and grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, that is the people of Israel, eschatological Israel at this point is what we're looking at, you know, the kingdom Israel, right? How much more will these who are Jewish people, that is the natural branches, be grafted back into their own olive tree? The people of Israel, or kingdom Israel. Lest you be wise in your own sight, I want you to understand this mystery, brothers. A partial hardening has come upon Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. What is this partial hardening? We spoke about this already. We spoke about this idea. This hardening is something imposed by God on his own people. A partial hardening, as Paul sees it, in order to buy time for the redemption, to forestall the final judgment. That's how Paul's reading it or explaining it to us here in Romans chapter 10 and 11. So he says, I want you to understand this mystery. Partial hardening has come upon Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. So the question is that everybody would like to have answered is, what is the fullness of the Gentiles? Because if we understood what the fullness of the Gentiles is, then we should be able to calculate when it's come in, when we have this fullness of the Gentiles, and then we should be able to know when the end times will come, right? And this final redemption.
Is this,
yes.
Partial hardening that's come upon Israel. Could we say that that is their not being able to recognize that Yeshua is the Messiah?
Yeah. Yeah, so, okay, let's define the partial hardening. The partial hardening is the rejection of the revelation of the gospel through Yeshua of Nazareth. How's that? Rejection of the revelation of the gospel through Yeshua of Nazareth. So it's not just, I don't think he's the Messiah, but it's also a rejection of who he is, what he taught, and what he stands for. That's how I would understand this partial hardening. But it's interesting that Paul doesn't say a hardening has come upon the people, but he says a partial hardening. And you might think that this partial hardening is partial because there's Messianic Jewish believers who are a remnant, and so it can't be a complete hardening, but that doesn't follow. That doesn't follow the argument. He's already made it clear that he's speaking about the branches that are cut off. The branches that are cut off are the ones that are under a partial hardening. So then the question that we should ask is, okay, if we've defined what part is hardened, what part is unhardened? What's the not hardened part?
Is that the waiting and role of the Mashiach?
Yeah, so, well, I would say, you know, if we're understanding the hardening to be in response to the revelation of God. Okay, so this hardening is in response to the revelation of God as it comes through Messiah. All right, that's the partial hardening. Then, if that's a part of the pie, then the rest of the pie should be the rest of the revelation, the rest of the revelation of God that's come to the Jewish people. Does it make sense?
Through Yeshua himself and his teachings?
No, that would be the partial hardening. Imagine a pie. All right. Doesn't matter what kind of pie. It's a revelation pie. This is a pie of divine revelation. Whether that divine revelation comes through the Torah of Moses, the prophets, okay, through individual revelation of God speaking, you know, revealing himself, or through the teaching, testimony, proclamation of the gospel of Yeshua of Nazareth, and then through his apostles. All right, so these are all different forms of revelation. I'll show you. Just to illustrate the point, so you know that I'm not just out, you know, making stuff up. I wouldn't do that. Wouldn't just make stuff up. I'd be dead wrong. I'll be dead wrong sometimes, but I didn't just make it up. That's not why I'm wrong, because I just made it up. It's because I thought about it, and I came to the wrong conclusion. That will be why I'm wrong. But here's the whole pie, okay? Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers, in the prophets, in many portions, and in many ways. Did you hear the in many portions? Those are different pieces of pie in our Revelation pie. So many portions, many ways. The many different ways are also different pieces of pie. In these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed. That's the piece of pie that I'm speaking of, is the revelation of Yeshua, to which we have been partially, because we're only taking a part of the pie, partially hardened. So Israel has been partially hardened in regard to this revelation, the one that came in these last days in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. All right, that's Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1. All right, so when we speak of the nation of Israel being, non-Yeshua-believing Jewish people being partially hardened, that hardening is only in regard to this revelation through Yeshua. That's clear now. That has the implication, though, that there's still all this other pie as well, right, to which we're not partially hardened. And that's important, because if you thought that the Jewish people were completely hardened to all revelation, then you might become arrogant towards the Jewish people. You might become cocky and start to think, oh, we've replaced you. You're not in God's game plan anymore. You're no longer God's people anymore, because you're hardened to the revelation of God, whereas we are not. God's talking to us, not you. You might come to those sorts of conclusions. We get miracles, you don't. We get revelations from God, you don't. God hears our prayers, not yours.
We get grace, you don't.
We get grace, yeah, and so on and so forth. Okay, so, I mean, you can see, if we come to a complete hardening, that plays into replacement theology, which is exactly what Paul is warning us about there. Now, you might say, yes, but it's the best piece of the pie. You start to realize what this pie is made of. You know, the whole pie is coming. This revelation is ultimately through Yeshua. Yes. The question of why forestall the redemption? It's really the same question that Paul's dealing with here of why delay the redemption? And the answer is that he has for us. You might not find this answer satisfying, but Paul says that the reason the redemption is delayed is so that the fullness of the Gentiles might come in. We're going to leave this partial hardening of the Jewish people and try to figure out what fullness of the Gentiles is now. Okay? All right. We've seen that Paul camps heavily on the concept of his ministry to the Gentiles being based on prophecies about the role of the Gentiles in the Messianic era. And in fact, the apostolic decision in Acts 15 is based on the reason that the apostles decided that the Gentiles can remain as Gentiles and don't need to become Jewish, and in fact shouldn't become Jewish in Acts 15, was based on a text that they pulled out of Amos, chapter 9, which indicates that there are Gentiles who are called by God's name in the Messianic era. And so if the Gentiles are called by God's name in the Messianic era, then this indicates that Gentiles, the nations, have a big role in the kingdom. And then we have all these texts and prophecies in Isaiah and in other prophets about how the nations are going to be wrapped into the kingdom in the Messianic era, under the Davidic king, under King Messiah. And peoples that you didn't know are going to run to you, and he will raise his signal for the nations, and they will rally to him, and so on and so forth. These many, many, many passages. So, we could understand the fullness of the Gentiles to simply refer to the completion in the Messianic era, that there will be this full number of nations to fulfill these prophecies, whatever that should be. All nations? representatives of all nations, every tribe and tongue, perhaps, or perhaps that's all that it means, which is quite a bit. I don't mean to deprecate it to say all that it means. I think that's a good understanding of it. But let me throw out some alternative understandings. One of them that I've heard, fullness of the Gentiles, that Paul is referring to the time of the Gentiles. Okay, so the time of the Gentiles comes from time of the Gentiles, will come from the teachings of Yeshua, in when he speaks of Jerusalem will be trodden under by the Gentiles. Luke 21. There you go. Luke 21:24. They will fall by the edge of the sword. They will be led captive into all nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. All right. So, what is the time of the Gentiles here in Luke 21? It's the exile. This is just another way of another term for this current exile, the time of the Gentiles. And so, from that perspective, prophecy teacher might look at this and say, time of the Gentiles is the exile. And when is the time of the exile fulfilled? When the return from exile begins. And the return from exile has been underway for more than a century now. And the formation of the modern state of Israel is a sure sign of the end of the exile. Well, it's not the end of the exile.
You would state temple sacrifices, that's exile.
Even
though they're in the land, even though they have Jerusalem, you have to end
it. Right. So the formation of the modern state of Israel may indeed be an indication of the end of exile, that the end of exile is looming near. I truly believe that. That's what it indicates.
Does the redemption actually occur if all those aren't in place? If you have the temple...
Right. No, that's correct. Are you sure that's in Avoda?
It's Avoda Kokavim. I want to say it's either chapter 8 or chapter 10. It's either the 8th chapter, 10th verse, or the 10th chapter, 8th verse.
Okay. Well, we should look at that. That's interesting. Because that might... I'm just thinking of Maimonides in Hilchot, is got... He lays out that same criteria out. Says these are the things that we need to see, and then we'll know we have King Messiah when these things are established. So that,
well,
yeah.
Well, in the time of the Second Temple, the Yovel hadn't been reinstated.
No, it had not. So anyway, point is that it's difficult to ascertain the end of exile until you have all of these pieces in place. So even though we can say that the formation of the modern state of Israel and the return of the Jewish people is the most exciting thing to happen in our lifetimes and our fathers' lifetimes, it's the most exciting thing to happen for nearly 2,000 years, in fact, in terms of prophecy being fulfilled and the eschatological clock ticking away and holy cow, this religion is real. What we're seeing is the beginning of the redemption, but it's not the redemption. We're not there yet. That's all sort of a rabbit trail, because I don't think that's what Paul is referring to when he refers to the fullness of the Gentiles. I don't think he's referring to the exile here at all. I don't think he's saying a partial hardening has come upon Israel until the exile is concluded. Although that makes total sense, and it fits with the eschatology. So you could read it that way. But I like to think that it's referring to the fullness of the Gentiles refers to this, as the theme of the chapter has been, the reason for the stalling the redemption is that the Gentiles would have time to repent, to receive the revelation that's coming through Yeshua, which is Paul's ministry that he's so excited about in the first place and is really the point of the whole epistle. And so the fullness of the Gentiles is the full number that God has called from the Gentiles to join the kingdom and to be part of the kingdom. That's how I would understand it. And so there's a possibility that Paul is actually invoking a text from this week's Torah portion, from our Parsha this week. In our Parsha, because we are in Parshat Vayechi, which is the Torah portion where Jacob is dying, and he bestows his blessing upon Joseph's sons, and he bestows his blessing upon all of his sons. He does a maneuver with Joseph's sons where He blesses Joseph's sons, but not only does he bless Joseph's sons, he adopts them. First, he adopts them. He adopts these two boys as his own sons. Now, they were already his grandsons. But he adopts them as his own sons, thereby elevating them to the level of Simeon and Reuben. He says, just as Simeon and Reuben are mine, Ephraim and Manasseh will be mine. Any other children you have, Joseph, will be yours. But these two boys are mine. And the Torah doesn't really explain why he does this. The answer is that he wanted to bestow upon Joseph the firstborn blessing, which is a double portion. The firstborn inheritance, I should say, as well, which is a double portion. Everybody understand that concept, double portion? So I don't need to go into that. Okay. Say there's a pie. Say you had a pie.
Again with pie, yeah.
Right. So the firstborn gets two pieces of pie, and all the other sons only get one piece of pie. So he wanted to make sure that Joseph got the two pieces of pie, but he thought, how's that going to happen? That's not really fair. Reuben's the firstborn. And so he says, I have an idea. He says, Joseph, I'm going to disinherit you. And, not literally, but I am going to replace you with your two sons. So he replaces him. And maybe, since Joseph had been assumed dead, he was already out of the will or something, But he adds two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, thereby ensuring that Joseph's family will receive this two pieces of pie of the double portion. And then when he blesses these sons, he says over Ephraim, he crosses his hands and he blesses, and Joseph says, whoa, you've got that wrong. This one's the firstborn. Manasseh is the firstborn. And Jacob says, I know what I'm doing. He blesses Ephraim, and he puts this specific blessing on Ephraim. He says, he will become a fullness of nations, which is exactly the same thing as saying fullness of Gentiles. So here's the thing. For Paul to use the term fullness until the fullness of Gentiles, or until the fullness of nations, it's exactly the same. For him to use that terminology, it's hard for me to imagine that he could possibly use that terminology without immediately thinking of the blessing over Ephraim. Maybe it's just a coincidence. But I don't think so. I think Paul has in mind Jacob's blessing, where Jacob blesses Ephraim and says, you will become, or his seed will become, a fullness of nations. And now Ephraim is here in Jacob's mind is representing the chief tribe, is the son of Joseph. It should remind us when we come to this point, we come to the end of these patriarchal narratives, what began with Abraham and went to Isaac and went to Jacob and now is being passed to Joseph's and his brothers and his two sons. We come to the end of the book of Genesis. This kind of sums everything up. The promise that began with Abraham, and how did the promise begin with Abraham? It began with, in your seed, all families of the earth will be blessed. Right? That was the beginning, and now we come to the end of this narrative of blessings that are being passed on. And it says, his seed, so again the seed language, his seed will become a fullness of nations. Now, this is a big teaching that I spun out of a couple words that Paul uses, fullness of nations. But I think this is all Pauline thoughts. We've seen the grafting in, for example, we saw that was a Pauline thought, that the very metaphor of being grafted in was a Pauline thought based upon an alternative reading of the Hebrew that says, in your seed, all families of the earth will be blessed, which could be read as will be grafted in. So, what I'm suggesting is that Paul has all of these associations running in his head, and the really remarkable thing is that he expects his readers to kind of catch this too and be tracking along with him, which is blows me away. Of course, there's just a possibility that they didn't whatsoever, or perhaps These people are so much more biblically literate than we are that this stuff is just it's making sense to them without a 20-week class to explain it or to unpack it. Who knows? Maybe it took them 20 weeks to get through the epistle. I don't know.
Yes, but isn't he still talking to you Gentiles?
Yeah.
Who probably are new.
Right, right. Yeah. That's what amazes me with these, you know, as he addresses, and this isn't the only instance. Here, yes, he's specifically addressing these Gentiles. He's using this, what you could call high-level associations, allusions, biblical language, rabbinic interpretations, and so forth. And this isn't the only instance. I would point you to several to other Pauline epistles where he's specifically speaking only to Gentiles, only to a Gentile readership, like Galatians. You know, and there again, it's not like we would expect things to be really kind of like, let's keep it simple. There's a God. He made you. He's the maker of heaven and earth. You know, not the case. Not the case,
so
not at all.
At that time, it seems like a messianic concept linked Noah Agoyim with...
The Two House movement has picked it up and said, see, we are Ephraim.
Yes,
Gentiles are literally Ephraim.
Yeah. British Israelism is underneath
right.
the tent.
Right. So, because what Paul is hinting at here by using this language is he is saying that the Gentile believers are the fullness of Ephraim's seed. They just don't know it. And he's hinting because they're lost tribes. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a natural link into Ezekiel 36.
And yeah, there's a natural link to Ezekiel 36 and two sticks. And once you are on that train, I'll tell you, it leaves the station really fast. So, yeah, absolutely. Now, so then the result is, from a Messianic Jewish reading, is like, whoa, we don't want to even, don't be talking that kind of language, because we know where that leads. Okay, the thing is, if that was the case, why is Paul doing this whole rabbit chase about you Gentiles and all that sort of thing, and now you were taken from an uncultivated olive tree and grafted in and all this sort of stuff?
You know, wouldn't he have identified
right.
them as...
Right. He would just... Why the secrecy? No, I mean, if Paul is actually suggesting that these are the lost tribes or something like that, which, by the way, weren't lost in the first century, but if Paul is suggesting that these are the lost tribes of Israel, there's no point to anything he ever writes about Gentiles and Jews, and I mean, at all. Or this whole idea of I'm the apostle to the Gentiles, or... Two House teaching misuses this passage. I don't think that in any way diminishes Paul's intention, or that we should obscure Paul's intention of alluding to the prophecy of the blessing over Ephraim. Okay, so let's make sure we have it nailed down then. The fullness of the nations, as I'm understanding it here, the fullness of the nations refers to the blessings that were invested in Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and ultimately passed to Ephraim, that all nations will be blessed through Abraham, through Abraham's family, through Abraham's seed, which Paul understands to be through the Messiah. Paul understands this. He makes this explicit. He makes this clear in other places. Even earlier in Romans, this idea of that Abraham is called the father of many nations because of these Gentiles that will believe in the seed of Abraham, and so forth. So, from that perspective, the fullness of the nations is simply, if you want to fill in the blank, the fullness of the nations is the Gentile believers. So that when he says, until a partial hardening has come upon Israel, until the fullness of the Gentile believers, the full number of the Gentile believers, I guess you could say, has come in into the kingdom.
A set number.
Well, I don't know.
A set number of days,
Gentiles,
or a set number of something.
He's just invoking a prophecy.
Yeah.
He's invoking a prophecy. I'm not saying there's a set number. I'm not saying that God's like counting them off and saying, you know, if we could just get to, you know, another, you know, or something like that. I'm not suggesting that at all. Why should it end up with Ephraim instead of Judah?
Right. I mean, Judah and...
Well, that's a whole other issue. The question of why doesn't the Messiah come from Ephraim? It seems like he should. But then he ends up coming from Judah. Yep. That's a whole other issue. And the answer that the sages offered, as we've learned elsewhere, is that there's actually two Messiahs. There's the Messiah from Ephraim, called Messiah, son of Joseph, who is the suffering Messiah that dies on behalf of Israel. And then there's the Messiah from Judah, that's Messiah, son of David, who is the Messiah who will rule for the kingdom. And that's the rabbinic answer.
Nice.
Right? And so the revelation that comes to us through Yeshua teaches us that this is incorrect, that there are not two Messiahs, but there's one Messiah who comes twice. And because I have a whole theory on why that is, but it's because Jeroboam screwed up.
What? People screwing up in the
Israelite. Yeah, it's because Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who was offered the kingdom, refused it and established his own gig. So he lost. So then the blessing that would have rested upon Ephraim, that's Jacob speaks of here, passed back to Judah, back to the house of David. And the house of David takes all. Winner takes all. Takes the whole pie. Imagine that the nation of Israel was a pie. And there were 12 pieces to this pie. All right. The prophet Ahijah comes and says,
"Are you hungry?"
says, I give you, Jeroboam, son of Nebat, I give you 10 pieces of pie, but I'm going to reserve 2 pieces of pie for my servant David. All right? Jeroboam says, "No thanks, don't want any pie. I'll make my own pie." And so the whole pie goes to the house of David. Messiah comes through David, and Messiah carries the blessing of the house of Ephraim. So he dies, he suffers and dies as Messiah, son of Joseph. He rises and will return as Messiah, son of David. That's the short answer. So Paul says, in this way, when the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, all Israel will be saved, as it's written regarding the final redemption and the new covenant in Isaiah 59:20. The deliverer will come from Zion. He will banish ungodliness from Jacob. And see how I've bolded the text, banish ungodliness from Jacob, because that text makes Paul think of another similar passage from Isaiah that he quotes, and it's written regarding the final redemption in Isaiah 27:9, and this will be my covenant with them when I take away their sins. So I've bolded that, when I take away their sins, because that corresponds to banish ungodliness from Jacob. Now, if we were to look at these two passages, we would see that both of them are in reference to the kingdom. First, Isaiah 59:1, a redeemer will come to Zion, to those in Jacob who turn from transgression, declares the Lord. So, to those who repent. As for me, this is my covenant with them. So here's our new covenant. My spirit that is upon you, my words that I've put in your mouth shall not depart from your mouth or out of the mouth of your offspring or out of the mouth of your children's offspring, says the Lord, from this time and forevermore. All right, so that's one passage, and it's a passage about the redemption. To those who turn from transgression, to those who repent. Here's the other one he quoted, also a redemption passage. Isaiah 27, therefore, by this, the guilt of Jacob will be atoned for. That's the part he quoted. And this will be the full fruit of the removal of his sin. In that day, the river Euphrates to the brook of Egypt, the Lord will thresh out the grain. And you will be gleaned one by one, O people of Israel. Rashi understands that, or the Jewish tradition understands this to be in reference to the resurrection of the dead, interestingly enough. And in that day a great trumpet will be blown, and those who were lost in the land of Assyria, so here's the exile, end of exile, those who were lost in the land of Assyria, and those who were driven out to the land of Egypt will come, they will come up from exile, and worship the Lord on the holy mountain at Jerusalem, that is the temple restored in Jerusalem, end of exile. So Paul expects that we know the context of these two passages that he just quoted a little bit of. So he says, look, in the redemption, we've got plenty of texts that tell us all Israel is going to be saved in the redemption. And we might compare with this. Behold, the days are coming when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. I will forgive their iniquity and remember their sin no more. So in the redemption, in the kingdom, God's going to remove the sin of his people. All right. So where does this leave us now? It leaves us with a complicated relationship between the believers and the rest of the Jewish people. Between Messianic Jews and non-Messianic Jews. Between Messianic Gentiles, Gentile believers, and non-believing Israel. We've already learned that we're not to be arrogant. Just because we have our piece of the pie doesn't mean we have the whole pie, or that no one else has any pie. Okay. So, we learned that we're not to be arrogant. Yes. But what about our relationship with the rest of Israel? Paul says a very interesting thing in that regard. He says, as regards the gospel, so as regards this single piece of pie of the revelation of Yeshua, all right, they, this time being non-believing Israel, are enemies for your sake. Now, I crossed off the words of God because they're supplied by the translator. That's strong language to supply, yeah? Enemies of God. Right. So as regards the gospel, they are enemies. Whose enemies? Not God's enemies.
Oh, wow.
They're your enemies. Regarding the gospel. Regarding that piece of pie. Specifically regarding that piece of pie. You can agree on the rest of the pie. But regarding that piece of pie, the revelation of Yeshua, they are enemies for your sake. But as regards election, that is being chosen, the chosen people. So we're not talking about predestination here or anything like that. As regards being the chosen people, they are beloved for the sake of their forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So this is the merit of the patriarchs, the merit of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The promises made to the fathers still stand regardless of.
Wow.
Why? Paul says, for the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. You can't undo God's calling. You cannot take back the gifts that God has already bestowed. So if God's bestowed all the other pieces of pie already, just because they didn't accept this last piece doesn't cancel the rest of the pie. Make sense? Okay, so now we're able to finish up. For just as you, Gentile believers, were at one time idolaters, disobedient to God, but now have received mercy only because of the Jewish people's disobedience, which has forestalled the redemption and the final judgment. So likewise, the Jewish people, too, have now been disobedient to the good news message in order that by the mercy shown to you, they may also now receive mercy. For God has consigned all to disobedience, that he may have mercy on all. Now, that's not real clear to me. Maybe it's very clear to you. It's very profound, I'm sure of that. But it's not very clear to me. I see two possibilities here in this passage. One is that salvation has come to the Gentiles, that he's saying salvation has come to the Gentiles to make Israel jealous. When he says, so they, the Jewish people, too, have now been disobedient to the good news message in order that mercy shown to you, by the mercy shown to you, they may also receive mercy. So remember how earlier he was saying, I'm hoping that by bringing in this number from the nations, I will provoke the rest of the Jewish people to jealousy. So that might be what he has in mind. Or perhaps he has in mind some sort of mystical spiritual symbiosis. You know what a symbiosis is? Yeah, okay. It's a symbiotic relationship is where two different species are living together in the same biological niche, and it's a mutual benefit to both. And in fact, if you were to take away the one species, the other would perish, because it's a symbiotic codependency, I guess, is the way it works. So perhaps this goes, and this is what's suggested when Paul says, if the root is holy, so are the branches. You can take that however you want. I don't know. He's not clear. But here's what he says, just for the record. They too have now been disobedient in order that by the mercy shown to you, they may also now receive mercy. So the way that I understand that is that by being a believer, and this is an incredible thought, by being a believer, a Gentile is contributing to the salvation of Israel, to the salvation of God's people, just by confessing Yeshua of Nazareth. And I'm not talking about being a missionary or anything like that. I'm just talking about by being a believer, a confessing believer in Yeshua of Nazareth, and receiving the revelation of the gospel, that the Gentile believer is in some way participating in the mechanism of the salvation of all Israel and the final redemption. For God has consigned all to disobedience. For the Gentiles, it's idolatry and secularism nowadays, which is, you know, the flip side, I suppose. For the Jewish people, it's the rejection of the revelation of the gospel that came through Yeshua of Nazareth and secularism, by the way, today. But the point is that nobody has a corner on truth here. This is what he's saying. Nobody has this corner on truth. Instead, everybody is consigned, as he says, to disobedience in order that God can have mercy on everyone. It's a pretty broad, universal, sweeping, beautiful statement. In fact, it's such a profound thought that Paul says, excuse me, I just got to say a doxology. I have to stop and worship in the middle of this epistle. I just need to stop and worship God because this is so amazing. And so that's the closing doxology where he says, oh, the depths and the riches and the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments. How inscrutable his ways. Who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor? How would we have ever figured this all out? Who has given him a gift that he may be repaid? And you can see the references Paul is pulling from. For from him, and through him, and to him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen. So this is, I don't know which, we were counting doxologies for a while. I lost count. But this one is a super doxology. Yeah, it's the fireworks are going off type of doxology. All right, so that's the end of chapter 11. We finished the hard part of Romans. Romans 9, 10, and 11. I said we get through Romans 9, 10, and 11. The rest will be easy. From here on out, we can wrap up the book pretty easily.
Thank you for studying the Book of Romans with us at BethEmmanuel.org. If you like what you are learning here, please consider supporting Beth Emmanuel with a financial gift by clicking on the Support tab at BethEmmanuel.org.